Dr. Margolis, you were telling us of having met Esther, your wife, and that 2 years later you were married. Could you tell us when you were married and where, as long as you're talking about your marriage?
Yes, we were married in 37.
Oh, 33.
33.
Sorry. 33, of course. 33. We were married in 1933 in Chicago, where Esther's family lived then. Her mother, brother. I had to go there while I was taking care of a very sick patient who was referred to me by a patient here. This patient was a New Yorker who had come on business and had a severe erysipelas. It was trying and difficult and discouraging to try to treat it when we had no antibiotics, of course. I managed to pull him through enough so that his erysipelas had faded considerably when we all took him back to New York after having been married. Mm-hmm. So our honeymoon started out in practice.
You were already in Pittsburgh practicing,
yes,
when you were married.
Yes. Anyway,
he joined you at your honeymoon.
Just to New York.
Just to New York.
Then he was picked up by his family, and he arranged that we take a cruise to Havana in appreciation. So we had a cruise on a boat which sank to the bottom of the sea a couple of years later after a fire. We were favored right from the beginning.
Yes.
And so was our marriage in all these years. And we have two sons, and we have a wonderful daughter we acquired through one of these sons.
Could you give us the names of your sons and your daughter-in-law?
Yes. One of our sons is Richard in New York. He studied at the University of Chicago, did his undergraduate work there, and although he had thought of studying medicine to practice, he had also had a great desire to do research and discussed with us switching from clinical medicine to research. So for his postgraduate work, he did work in biochemistry and got his PhD in that. And just before getting his PhD in that, he also discussed with us the possibility of going into medical school at the University of Chicago, because his chairman of the department also had an MD and PhD degree, and suggested that Richard would get a broader view of medicine, both basically and humanly, by doing that. And of course, I was thrilled at that idea. So Richard, in 3 years, was able to get his MD degree, because his first year was covered by his basic work. Rene, whom he met just before he left for his second year, when she was entering the first year at the University of Chicago, her mother and father, who was a physician, a pathologist in Pittsburgh, arranged a little party at their home so that she could meet University of Chicago students. And Richard, who wasn't a party boy on his own, decided to go there and got immediately settled in love after seeing and talking with Renee. And it was great judgment. He would have been married the next day. But we indicated, although he knew, that it was impossible to support another family. Mm-hmm. And so they waited until the end of Renee's 4 years. And the next day after graduation, they were married in Chicago.
That was a long wait.
That's a long wait, and that was pretty characteristic of Richard. It was something was logical. It was the right thing to do. Renee went on to get her PhD in biochemistry, and they have been working ever since jointly in biochemistry research, publishing together, doing the same research essentially in two different laboratories, and it's been a wonderful thing. We feel that both Richard and Renee has decided that having children the way they would feel children should be raised would be an impossibility because of their great ambition in achieving in their research and in what they would have to give to a family. And we feel now that they were absolutely right about that. So they've been accomplishing a great deal. They are now regarded as important members of the senior group of researchers in neurochemistry, and published a great deal. We just got another book which they edited with beautiful reviews. So the whole situation has worked out magnificently. John, who is 4 years younger, went to Haverford College and decided to go into English literature. I thought he would make a wonderful lawyer and researcher, but he felt absolutely differently. And I know he was right, more so now than ever. So he finished Haverford with Phi Beta Kappa, a key, and also a mission as a fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Fellowship. I think it's called at Princeton University. So he went, and at Princeton there was an outstanding English literature professor whom John was very interested in studying with. So he got his PhD in English literature at Princeton and went in to teach English, which he enjoyed very much. He landed at Northwestern University, where, as Richard, landed in New York at New York University. And they have been there consistently. They haven't been jumpers around, which we feel was a good thing. Anyway, after a number of years of teaching English, for some reason, they asked John to go into administration as associate dean of the humanities department. He accepted that for a couple of years. And then they asked him to accept a promotion to associate provost at the university, which he again accepted and has been in administration since, still hoping that someday he's going to release himself to go into teaching English literature and writing.
Has he done any writing?
Oh, yes. He wrote a wonderful little book on Eliot during his Princeton year, which was published, and then two others, one on Crutch, K-R-U-T-C-H, and another one on the principles of higher education as he saw it as a youngster, as a young person. It was quite interesting.
Yes.
The boys come often to visit us, and we go to New York or Chicago once in a long while, particularly nowadays. Mm-hmm. But they are very devoted children, including our daughter, and we get a tremendous amount of joy when we're with them, and when we realize what they are accomplishing in their lives.
And what's interesting is that you too had aspirations for them, but you allowed them to follow their own inclinations.
Yes, surely that's right. I felt and feel even today that Richard has a wonderful insight into clinical medicine. And many times I discuss with him medical problems and respect his judgment about what he sees, even though he has not been in clinical medicine for 20 years. But when he suggested going into basic science for a lifetime, I felt that that's good, that's wonderful. And how can one object to that?
Right.
With John, again, I felt he would make a wonderful lawyer because he loved to analyze things, to research them, and to establish his judgment about them. And told him so. Tried even to convince him to study law just for teaching for the rest of his life. Because teaching law, I thought, would be an interesting project for him. But he would have none of that. And it was as if he foresaw the legal profession just as we see it. We find so many outstanding lawyers now wondering how in the world they ever got in there. But still, I know some wonderful young people, including your family,
right.
And who are interested and working beautifully in that field. But it's a difficult field now. It's not what it used to be, apparently. Actually, in all of my life, from the earliest days that I can remember, the family was the most important thing for living. And as a matter of fact, the family has always been pretty close in one way, another, and not practically every way. To this day, we feel so.
Are you talking about your immediate family of you and Esther and your sons, or your extended family of
family in every sense of the word? For example, when I was in medical school, I happened to have one summer vacation period when I was quite successful in raising some profit. I was selling some electrical supplies at the suggestion of my uncle. And I was fairly successful that summer, covering my tuition, etc. And with the help of my uncle, decided we ought to bring over here my grandparents, my school teacher aunt, and a sister of hers, which we did. And they, of course, were very happy to have come here. They worked out in a wonderful life for the remaining years they had. And my school teacher aunt's husband eventually landed in New York, where he was able to work at a good job, which he enjoyed. And they were, it was a wonderful family relationship. And at the same time, it gave me the opportunity to repay just a very little bit of what I owed them.
You were particularly close, evidently, to the maternal aunt.
We were very close.
Yes, very close to the maternal family, because we'd lived with him.
But my, your aunt, the teacher?
My aunt, the teacher, was a goddess.
Yes.
And for some reason, she was very fond of me and gave me really almost an undue advantage, but a wonderful advantage in every sense of the word. She raised me a human being, for I'll never forget the way she got me dressed up for my first class. And the outfit that she sewed for me herself. And dressing me for the first day at school was as if I were going to meet the king. Mm-hmm. Yes, she was a really outstanding person, and for me, a godsend. And that's what we need in the lives of so many, many, many children in our world today. Which isn't available to them. She
did not live in Pittsburgh when she came to America.
She came to Pittsburgh. They all came to Pittsburgh first. But it was decided that her husband would have a better chance of getting his job in his field in New York. And they were right. It turned out that way. So they lived in Pittsburgh for several years. And then went to New York, where they lived the rest of their lives. And I would see them, of course.
Was she teaching her?
No, she didn't work here. She had a little girl, but she didn't work here. That brings us to return to coming into Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. where, of course, I started in practice.
What year was that?
1930, and I was greeted by the most wonderful depression that could have been arranged, but I was able to weather it somehow or other, not easily and not painlessly, but practically, established myself in the hospital as well as within circle of physicians.
But you were by yourself when you opened up?
Yes, I was by myself first, but as soon as I developed a fairly active practice, I got ideas about a clinic, like the Mayo Clinic, mm-hmm. and a miniaturization of that was to bring in a first associate, which happened to be a wonderful lady physician, Dr. Schnurr, S-C-H-N-U-R-E-R. She later became a
psychiatrist,
which was her official reason. But she was a wonderful associate, and we were great, wonderful friends. And then, of course, the practice grew, and my associations and the staff grew, and we were very happily settled.
What hospitals were you connected with at that time?
Montefiore. Mm-hmm. Connected to Montefiore, which was great at first, but when I got very busy in practice, I was unable to get the beds I needed for admission of patients with arthritis, because that wasn't a favorite type of patient then, when there was no Blue Cross or anything else.
Yes.
But I struggled through, managed, later got a call from St. Margaret's asking me if I would join them. And I did. I had the most happy experience there. I developed an arthritis service there. And with the wonderful people, I was able to bring to join me. There was great progress at St. Margaret's. And as a matter of fact, it will forever be a great rheumatologic center because of these people that came with me.
When you started in 1930, were there many rheumatologists in Pittsburgh? Was this really very special?
No, there were no medical rheumatologists. Orthopedists used to see these patients, so, but medical rheumatologists, there were none. And as I found out later, through a lecture that Dr. Rodman gave, when he researched the question, he found that I was the very first trained fellow in rheumatology in the country. There were other rheumatologists at Harvard here and there who developed out of self-training, and they were wonderful people. But for a trained rheumatologist, I was touched. And it was helpful. It was respected by the Pittsburgh medical community, and they supported me and helped me. And I enjoyed that.
So that meant that other doctors referred patients to you?
Yes, I developed a very large referral practice and a direct practice as well, through the patients who were referred. And, of course, with the development of the field of rheumatology, I was able to make use of whatever progress was made. I'll never forget the first time I read the article on the use of gold in treatment. It seemed almost unbelievable, but in actual practice, as I tried this, it proved that every once in a while a patient would develop a really striking remission such as we never saw before. Mm-hmm. So that it looked like I possibly chose an interesting field which will progress further, which it has done.
You probably had to do a lot of teaching because people are not as aware of your field.
Yes, we did a lot of lectures for medical societies, and also I was able to arrange to develop the first arthritis department at the University of Pittsburgh, where I would see patients and have students who were able to exchange ideas and teaching, so that it was a full-fledged practice of rheumatology. Which was both enjoyable and useful and meaningful.
Challenging too?
Yes, indeed. It was challenging.
It was so new to what we
can learn. Yes, it was, and it was interesting how people were so anxious for every bit of knowledge and help in this field.
For the people that you invited in with your practice, had they also been trained? Was the field developing so that you were bringing in trained rheumatologists as you had been trained?
Yes. At first, no. Mm-hmm. The first ones really were trained by me in actual practice. Later on, I was able to get some of the finest, really the cream of the crop in trained rheumatologists,
yes.
as Dr. Stolzer, for example, whom you know, and who was really recommended to me by Dr. Bunin in New York, at New York University, as an outstanding fellow there. And besides getting good training in rheumatology, he was a great human being, so he's been a joy.
So after you received your training, evidently it started to open up as a specialty. Is that true?
Yes, that it opened up in the country, in the world.
Yes, right.
Because there was some little bit of progress made in through research here and there, and there seemed to be some promise. And of course, there was this tremendous demand from patients and doctors who couldn't handle the problem. Incidentally, speaking of progress, Dr. Hinch, who from my earliest days with him on the service, was so brilliant and so full of imagination about possible progress, proved to be what I thought he would be, an outstanding contributor in the field. And actually, he won the Nobel Prize as one of the people with Dr. Kendall, who developed cortisone and who applied the use of cortisone.
What was Dr. Hench's first name?
Philip Hench. His father was headmaster at Shadyside Academy in Pittsburgh, and he came of a wonderful family, and he developed a wonderful family of his own. People, as people, have always been of great interest to me, and as a person, he attracted me very much, and I valued everything he did in my development and training.
He remained at Mayo?
He remained at Mayo's for a short time when he died.
So he was an older man when he left Pittsburgh to come to Mayo?
Yes.
But you had never heard of him?
No, here. As a matter of fact, he was, he told me, and I had heard, that he was not an outstanding medical student. Insofar as grades were concerned.
Nor was Einstein an outstanding student.
That's right, that's right. So it's interesting what happened. I have a beautiful letter which he wrote to me some years later as a friend, and expressing our meaning of our friendship, which I treasure. He was then, of course, a Nobel laureate.
For what did he receive the Nobel laureate? For what did he receive the Nobel laureate?
For the use of cortisone.
Oh, he was the one. Because you mentioned another doctor.
Yes, Kendall was a Mayo Clinic biochemist who, after many years of study and work, crystallized and developed cortisone to an extent through Dr. Hinch's stimulation of the possibility of it being useful in the management of arthritis. And so the two of them got the Nobel Prize for this, as well as a Swiss physician.
Mm-hmm.
Who also did the same work and also made the discovery of cortisone about the same time.
Well, what we are going to do is come to a finish at this point, but we are by far not finished because I have loads of questions. So we're going to talk again, okay? We'll make another time because we want to pick up a number of the background information that I would like to get.
Can't we do it today?
Well, it's kind of too long.
We'd
like to do it about an hour at a time, and we would make an arrangement that's suitable for you. But we have made a tremendous start.
Okay.
All right.